In Chicago, for example, the Reverend Greg Sackowitz, a Roman Catholic priest, mixes his religious teaching with rock and roll music. According to the Associated Press, the Reverend Sackowitz is both an associate pastor at the Church of the Holy Spirit in Schaumburg, a suburb of Chicago, and a disc jockey at WKQX. On his show, The Journey Inward, Father Sackowitz chats in soft tones about such topics as family relationships or commitment and interposes his sermons with the sound of Billboard's Top 10. He says that his preaching is not done in a churchy way and adds, "You don't have to be boring in order to be holy." Meanwhile, in New York City, at St. Patrick's Cathedral, Father John J. O'Connor put on a New York Yankee baseball cap as he mugged his way through his installation as Archbishop of the New York Archdiocese. He got off some excellent gags, at least one of which was specifically directed at Mayor Edward Koch, who was a member of his audience. That is to say, he was a congregant. At his next public performance, the new Archbishop donned a New York Mets baseball cap. These events were, of course, televised and were vastly entertaining, largely because Archbishop, now Cardinal, O'Connor has gone Father Sackowitz one better. Whereas the latter believes that you don't have to be boring to be holy, the former apparently believes you don't have to be holy at all. In Phoenix, Arizona, Dr. Edward Dietrich performed triple bypass surgery on Bernard Schuller. The operation was successful, which was nice for Mr. Schuller. It was also on television, which was nice for America. The operation was carried by at least 50 television stations in the United States, and also by the British Broadcasting Corporation. A two-man panel of narrators, a play-by-play and color man, so to speak, kept viewers informed about what they were seeing. It was not clear as to why this event was televised, but it resulted in transforming both Dr. Dietrich and Mr. Schuller's chest into celebrities. Perhaps because he has seen too many doctor shows on television, Mr. Schuller was uncommonly confident about the outcome of his surgery. "There is no way in hell they are going to lose me on live TV," he said. As reported with great enthusiasm by both WCBS-TV and WNBC-TV in 1984, the Philadelphia Public Schools have embarked on an experiment in which children will have their curriculum sung to them. Wearing Walkman equipment, students were shown listening to rock music whose lyrics were about the eight parts of speech. Mr. Jocko Henderson, who thought of this idea, is planning to delight students further by subjecting mathematics and history, as well as English, to the rigors of a rock music format. In fact, this is not Mr. Henderson's idea at all. It was pioneered by the Children's Television Workshop, whose television show Sesame Street is an expensive illustration of the idea that education is indistinguishable from entertainment. Nonetheless, Mr. Henderson has a point in his favor. Whereas Sesame Street merely attempts to make learning to read a form of light entertainment, the Philadelphia experiment aims to make the classroom itself into a rock concert. In New Bedford, Massachusetts, a rape trial was televised to the delight of audiences who could barely tell the difference between the trial and their favorite midday soap opera. In Florida, trials of varying degrees of seriousness, including murder, are regularly televised and are considered to be more entertaining than most fictional courtroom dramas. All of this is done in the interests of public education. For the same high purpose, plans are afoot, it is rumored, to televise confessionals. To be called Secrets of the Confessional Box, the program will, of course, carry the warning that some of its material may be offensive to children, and therefore parental guidance is suggested. On a United Airlines flight from Chicago to Vancouver, a stewardess announces that its passengers will play a game. The passenger with the most credit cards will win a bottle of champagne. A man from Boston with 12 credit cards wins. A second game requires the passengers to guess the collective age of the cabin crew. A man from Chicago guesses 128 and wins another bottle of wine. During the second game, the air turns choppy and the fastened seatbelt sign goes on. Very few people notice, least of all the cabin crew, who keep up a steady flow of gags on the intercom. When the plane reaches its destination, everyone seems to agree that it's fun to fly from Chicago to Vancouver. On February 7, 1985, the New York Times reported that Professor Charles Pine of Rutgers University, Newark campus, was named Professor of the Year by the Council for the Support and Advancement of Education. In explaining why he has such a great impact on his students, Professor Pine said, "I have some gimmicks I use all the time. If you reach the end of the blackboard, I keep writing on the wall. It always gets a laugh. The way I show what a glass molecule does is to run over to one wall and bounce off it and run over to the other wall." His students are, perhaps, too young to recall that James Cagney used this molecule move to great effect in Yankee Doodle Dandy. If I am not mistaken, Donald O'Connor duplicated it in Singin' in the Rain. So far as I know, it has been used only once before in a classroom. Hegel tried it several times in demonstrating how the dialectical method works. The Pennsylvania Amish try to live in isolation from mainstream American culture. Among other things, their religion opposes the veneration of graven images, which means that the Amish are forbidden to see movies or to be photographed. But apparently, their religion has not got around to disallowing seeing movies when they are being photographed. In the summer of 1984, for example, a Paramount Pictures crew descended upon Lancaster County to film the movie Witness, which is about a detective played by Harrison Ford who falls in love with an Amish woman. Although the Amish were warned by their church not to interfere with the filmmakers, it turned out that some Amish welders ran to see the action as soon as their work was done. Other devouts lay in the grass some distance away and looked down on the set with binoculars. "We read about the movie in the paper," said an Amish woman. "The kids even cut out Harrison Ford's picture." She added, "But it doesn't really matter that much to them. Somebody told us he was in Star Wars, but that doesn't mean anything to us." The last time a similar conclusion was drawn was when the executive director of the American Association of Blacksmiths remarked that he had read about the automobile, but that he was convinced it would have no consequences for the future of his organization. In the winter 1984 issue of the official video journal, there appears a full-page advertisement for the Genesis Project. The project aims to convert the Bible into a series of movies. The end product, to be called the New Media Bible, will consist of 225 hours of film and will cost $250 million. Professor John Heyman, whose credits include Saturday Night Fever and Grease, is one of the filmmakers most committed to the project. Simply stated, he is quoted as saying, "I got hooked on the Bible." The famous Israeli actor Topol, best known for his role as Tevi in Fiddler on the Roof, will play the role of Abraham. The advertisement does not say who will star as God, but given the producer's background, there is some concern that it might be John Travolta. At the commencement exercises at Yale University in 1983, several honorary degrees were awarded, including one to Mother Teresa. As she and other humanitarians and scholars each in turn received their awards, the audience applauded appropriately but with a slight hint of reserve and impatience, for it wished to give its heart to the final recipient, who waited shyly in the wings. As the details of her achievements were being recounted, many people left their seats and surged toward the stage to be closer to the great woman, and when the name Meryl Streep was announced, the audience unleashed a sonic boom of affection to wake the New Haven dead. One man who was present when Bob Hope received his honorary doctorate at another institution said that Dr. Streep's applause surpassed Dr. Hope's. Knowing how to please a crowd as well as anyone, the intellectual leaders at Yale invited Dick Cavett, the talk show host, to deliver the commencement address the following year. It is rumored that this year Don Rickles will receive a doctorate of humane letters, and Lola Falana will give the commencement address. Prior to the 1984 presidential elections, the two candidates confronted each other on television in what were called debates. These events were not in the least like the Lincoln-Douglas debates or anything else that goes by the name. Each candidate was given 5 minutes to address such questions as, "What is or would be your policy in Central America?" His opposite number was then given 1 minute for a rebuttal. In such circumstances, complexity, documentation, and logic can play no role, and indeed on several occasions syntax itself was abandoned entirely. It is no matter. The men were less concerned with giving arguments than with giving off impressions, which is what television does best. Post-debate commentary largely avoided any evaluation of the candidates' ideas, since there were none to evaluate. Instead, the debates were conceived as boxing matches, the relevant question being, who KO'd whom? The answer was determined by the style of the men, how they looked, fixed their gaze, smiled, and delivered one-liners. In the second debate, President Reagan got off a swell one-liner when asked a question about his age. The following day, several newspapers indicated that Ron had KO'd Fritz with his joke. Thus, the leader of the free world is chosen by the people in the age of television. What all of this means is that our culture has moved toward a new way of conducting its business, especially its important business. The nature of its discourse is changing as the demarcation line between what is show business and what is not becomes harder to see with each passing day. Our priests and presidents, our surgeons and lawyers, our educators and newscasters need worry less about satisfying the demands of their discipline than the demands of good showmanship. Had Irving Berlin changed one word in the title of his celebrated song, he would have been as prophetic, albeit more terse, as Aldous Huxley. He need only have written, "There's no business but show business."